Charles Lindbergh was one of the most famous men in the world throughout most of the 20th century. After his heroic solo flight across the Atlantic Ocean and the nightmare of his son's kidnapping, he lived constantly in the public eye. But one strange story about him seems to have gone unnoticed until now. Lindbergh was involved in experiments with a Nobel Prize winner, Dr. Alexis Carrel, in an attempt to conquer death. The Immortalists is David M. Friedman's new book about the project. It's published by HarperCollins, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to the show. Hello.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Was Charles Lindbergh one of the first Americans to become a cultural icon and be relentlessly pursued by the press?
I'd say he was, and he certainly.
I mean, he's a non-movie star.
Yes,
who experienced that.
And also, he was the first non-movie star to be pursued by the press when the mass media was really becoming mass for the first time. He was the most photographed person on Earth. There were more radio broadcasts about him than almost anybody else. He was almost like Elvis, really, and not an entertainer. So that's why it really made him very angry.
Well, what had he done before the Atlantic crossing?
Well, the funny thing is Lindbergh had failed at virtually everything in his life before he became a pilot. He was a bad student. He was a bad athlete. He was a bad farmer. But the one thing he could do was fly. He learned in the Army Air Corps and also at a flying school in Nebraska. And it's just something he understood right from the beginning, especially the engineering part of it. So it became a great success as a male pilot, and then he started flying across the country, and he set quite a few speed records before he took off for Paris.
Some people already knew that he was a special kind of pilot. But see, he doesn't seem to have a lot of personal charisma. What is it that made him so famous?
Well, part of it was he was very handsome. That had a lot to do with it. It was an age of stunts. And here he appeared to be the man who had pulled off the greatest physical feat of courage that anyone had ever seen. And you have to remember, six people had died trying or training to cross the Atlantic before him. So he really had conquered death in a way other people hadn't.
And conquering death is part of the story.
That's right.
What brought him to the laboratory of Dr. Carrel?
Lindbergh's sister-in-law, the sister of Anne Morrow Lindbergh, Lindbergh's wife, was slowly dying of a defective heart valve. And Lindbergh, who was something of a self-taught mechanical genius, could not understand how something as simple as a valve was causing so much problems for his sister-in-law, because he knew if he had a defective valve in his airplane engine, he could fix that. So one day when his wife, when Anne Morrow, was about to give birth to their first child, who was, of course, the Lindbergh baby, Lindbergh struck up a conversation with the anesthetist who was dealing with his wife, because he noticed he had brought a little machine he'd invented to give artificial respiration to newborns. And so Lindbergh started speaking to this anesthetist and said, "Can't we help my sister-in-law? You seem to understand bioengineering better than most doctors. Can't we help her?" And he said, "Well, you know, you have an idea about an artificial heart or replacing a valve." He said, "I can't answer those questions because I'm not a surgeon." But he said, "But I know someone, if there's anybody in the world who can answer those questions, it's Alexis Carrel." And he arranged a meeting between the two men.
Well, much more recently, someone did come up with an artificial heart valve.
Yes.
And then we had artificial heart. So this was not an outrageous idea.
No, they just didn't really, they didn't have the technology, nor did they really understand the biology to achieve it at that point in time.
Had Carrel already won the Nobel Prize?
Yes, he won the Nobel Prize in 1912 for perfecting anastomosis, vascular anastomosis, which gives surgeons the ability to connect a blood vessel after it's been cut, to patch it after it's been punctured, and to reroute it to attach an artery to a vein or a vein to an artery.
So he was the ideal man.
Yeah, and keep everything functioning. That was the key thing. So that made him the father of organ transplants and makes him the father of coronary artery bypass grafts.
What was his mandate at the Rockefeller Institute?
Well, his mandate was to do anything he wanted, and that was the whole purpose of the Rockefeller Institute. It was a place where doctors would be given free realm to explore whatever experiments they want, freed from the demands of clinical practice. And you have to remember that 100 years ago, when the Rockefeller Institute was established, the United States was not the place you wanted to go for medical treatment. Europe was. It was set up to compete with places like the Pasteur Institute in Paris and the Koch Institute in Berlin.
Of course, Carrel was a French doctor, so he had been brought over here, I guess, to raise the level of American science?
Well, actually, that's an interesting story. Carrel had been really blackballed out of the French surgical world because he had gone to Lourdes. He served on a pilgrim train, and there was a woman on this train that he was certain was dying. He gave her a shot of morphine, did not expect her to even survive the train trip, but when she got there, she was sprinkled with the healing waters and had a miraculous recovery, had a recovery. And Carrel said to himself, I cannot explain what I've seen scientifically. This should be investigated. So when he went back to the medical school at University of Lyon, where he was a student, and told everybody what he saw, he was essentially drummed out of medical school.
Because he was supporting ideas of supernatural phenomena. My guest is David M. Friedman, whose book, The Immortalist, Charles Lindbergh, Dr. Alexis Carrel, and Their Daring Quest to Live Forever, is published by Echo, which is a division of HarperCollins. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Weren't American scientists at all concerned about his interest in occult and parapsychology and the like?
Yes, they were, and it's one of the reasons why eventually Carrel was forced out of the Rockefeller Institute after a long career. And you have to remember, he was not only a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, he was the first Nobel Prize-winning scientist in the United States and at the Rockefeller Institute. So to get pushed out was quite a shock to him.
When Lindbergh showed up, did Dr. Carrel take him seriously?
Yes, he did. After he gave him one of his face tests, Carrel was a very eccentric man. He was a brilliant man, but a very eccentric man. And he believed in the pseudoscience of physiognomy. He believed that a person's face revealed their character. So before he would speak to anybody, he often insisted on scanning that person's face closely. So he did this to Lindbergh when Lindbergh arrived there in November 1930. And the irony of this, of course, is this is the most photographed face on Earth. But he still made Lindbergh submit to this test. And then they ended up striking a friendship that lasted until Carrel's death.
Was that face test something that he would have gotten out of eugenics? Because they used to measure heads and the like. All making something that was unscientific into something that sounded scientific?
Well, I can say this for certain, that Carrel certainly believed in eugenics, and so did Lindbergh. This is one thing that brought them together.
They thought they were superior beings.
Well, they did, and you have to remember this. One of the reasons why eugenics appealed to Lindbergh is that Lindbergh grew up on a farm. And when you breed animals on a farm, you breed from the best stock and you eliminate the weak stock. So eugenics made sense to him. The way Carrel expressed it to him was that the white race that had built civilization was in danger of drowning in a sea of inferiors. And this also made sense to Lindbergh because he had been brought up in a racist household in Minnesota. I don't want to really single out his parents for special blame. There are many Americans held racial views in 1902 when Lindbergh was born.
And Dr. Carrel was working on creating a master race of mice, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. One of the first experiments he showed Lindbergh in his operating room, in his laboratories, excuse me, was a glass-walled structure he called his mousery. There were as many as 50,000 mice inside this big glass box, and inside this glass box, the strong mice were encouraged to dominate and even kill the weaker mice. And after they fought, the winners were given females to impregnate, and the losers were given autopsies. And Carrel told Lindbergh this was the way the white race that became superior in the world had been created.
Well, this sounds very similar to what Hitler later believed should be done. Although Dr. Carrel, I suspect, wasn't a Nazi or a Nazi sympathizer, Lindbergh obviously was.
Yes, Lindbergh, actually, what's interesting, this is one of the few things Lindbergh and Carrel disagreed on. As I'm sure you know, Lindbergh made three very famous visits to Nazi Germany in the mid and late 1930s, which culminated in his accepting a medal from Hermann Göring at the U.S. Embassy in 1938. And when he went to Germany, he thought he saw the future. He saw one race united in a vision of national greatness committed to science and technology and also aviation. Carrel, on the other hand, while he supported fascist movements all over the world and famously said that democracy is an error of the brain, hated Germans because he was French. And the Germans were, in his view, the Huns from across the river who invaded France every few years. And he had been a surgeon in the French army in World War I, where he spent several very trying months sewing together French soldiers blown apart by German bombs and bullets.
Lindbergh strikes me as a guy who had a rather theoretical mindset. He actually used the principles that he'd learned on the farm to select his wife, didn't he?
Yes, he did. When he was embarked upon his girl meeting project, as he called it, he decided that he wasn't going to be fooled by makeup. He wasn't going to be fooled by nice clothes. The most important thing was breeding. The most important thing was you had to know their parents. And he said he learned that on the farm, and he decided it was definitely true of people as well. And the Morrows, I should point out, Anne Morrow was a member of the WASP elite in the United States. Her father, Dwight Morrow, was a partner at J.P. Morgan. He was a fantastically wealthy man. When Charles Lindbergh met Anne Morrow, Dwight Morrow, her father, was the American ambassador to Mexico. He later became the senator from New Jersey. And if you go over to Englewood, there's a Dwight Morrow High School named after him.
Some of the experiments that Carrel was doing on animals seem barbaric. This was before there were any animal rights activists, I suppose. But he discovered the first antiseptic?
Well, he discovered the first antiseptic that worked in wartime, and this was a huge breakthrough. In World War I, he and a chemist named Henry J. Dakin came up with a solution that was strong enough to kill the infection in a bullet wound, but yet mild enough to keep the healthy tissues alive. This was a gigantic breakthrough that saved millions of lives.
In one experiment, he would open the heart of an anesthetized animal to stop the flow of blood and then close the heart and resuscitate the animal. What was he researching there?
He was really, at this point in time, one of the problems with heart surgery was they couldn't keep the heart, they couldn't open the heart long enough to operate in it and keep the animal or the patient alive. So he was experimenting to see how long can we stop circulation and have the subject, the animals, be alive.
Well, this is something we're still dealing with, isn't it? We put people under, and we keep them just above death while we operate on them.
Yeah, but we do have heart-lung machines which sort of take over that work in open-heart surgery. But none of that would be possible without the work of Lindbergh and Carrel.
And you tell of an instance, perhaps the first instance, when Carrel's work was used to save a human, a five-day-old infant.
That's right. And I want to point out that you mentioned that he probably worked before there were organizations like PETA. Well, actually, there were organizations. They just weren't called PETA. And he was a constant target of these organizations, and they did try to close down his lab at the Rockefeller Institute. But it turns out that he did the first what they call direct blood transfusion in New York when a doctor at Columbia Medical School who had a five-day-old infant who had a rare childhood disease that caused her to bleed incessantly, or maybe not incessantly, but a little too frequently.
Like hemophilia?
No, kind of, but not exactly. Not as drastic. But she, when the doctor brought the baby over to Carrel's home, actually, the baby was white as a sheet and clearly near death. And what Carrel did was he attached a blood vessel from the father to the baby and had the blood from the father replenish the blood that was being lost by the daughter. This was before we knew very much about blood groups, and it turned out to be just a very lucky operation. And the baby Carrel later went to her 21st birthday party.
David N. Friedman's latest book is The Immortalists, Charles Lindbergh, Dr. Alexis Carrel, and Their Daring Quest to Live Forever. It's published by Echo. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with David M. Friedman, whose latest book is The Immortalists, Charles Lindbergh, Dr. Alexis Carrel, and Their Daring Quest to Live Forever, published by Echo, which is a division of HarperCollins. After they meet, Carrel takes Lindbergh into a room where the subjects aren't fully formed animals. What were they?
Actually, I'm glad you brought this up. They were pieces of tissue that he had kept alive outside of the body. Carrel is really the father of tissue culture and really all stem cell culture. He was the first person to grow human tissue outside of the body. He was also the first person to see cancer cells working outside of the body. So he was a very innovative biologist as well as being a fantastic surgeon.
And he managed to stabilize a chicken heart and
keep the tissue alive. Yeah, that was his most famous experiment and controversial experiment. And the reason he did it was this. He had already demonstrated, at least to his own satisfaction, that cells could be immortal if you just rinse them free of metabolites, which are the waste products left over after digestion.
Now, we recently had a guest on our show who says that stem cell research may lead to a point where we can live for hundreds and hundreds of years simply by replacing used parts.
Well, that was Carrel's idea. That's precisely what Lindbergh and Carrel were trying to do. The tricky part is, what do you do with the brain? And you have to remember that when Carrel first got this idea that the body was a living machine made out of constantly replaceable parts, it was around 1900. The average lifespan in 1900 was 49 years. So when he was talking about replacing parts, he meant like the body's moving parts, the heart, the kidney, the liver. He wasn't thinking really much about the brain, because there really wasn't that much senility in the world, and he was convinced those people who were senile didn't deserve to live longer.
So we have this weird thing. Carrel seems to have been a brilliant doctor and also a wild, crazy guy, doing Frankensteinish experiments in some cases, but also pointing the way for where medicine was going to go. And then here we have Lindbergh, who has his own weird side. But Lindbergh offers Carrel something that Carrel doesn't have. He is mechanical.
Yes. And you have to remember, in 1930, when they met, the Rockefeller Institute, even though it was the best-financed research center in the United States for biological matters, really had virtually none of the technology that modern researchers take for granted. You know, the mortar and pestle was used daily. You know, that's technology that goes back to the Stone Age. I know scientists still use the mortar and pestle, but now they also have, you know, computers and scanning electron microscopes. They had none of that back then. And the machine that Carrel was trying to make was a perfusion pump. It was essentially a mechanical device that would fool an organ that had been removed from the body into still thinking that it was inside the body. It was a pump that would send blood and other artificial nutrients into the organ and then drain the wastes as it came out. So it was a mechanical device. And Lindbergh was really something of a self-taught mechanical genius. He looked at the machine Carrel had been using unsuccessfully, and because there was infection all the time. And Lindbergh looked at it and said, you know, I think I can build you a better one. And it took him 5 years, but he did.
Mm-hmm. And the experiment actually worked?
Oh, yes, it did. And they were able to keep whole organs alive for weeks and even months at a time. And I mean fully functioning. I don't mean packed in ice. You know, that we now, when they do an organ transplant, they take an organ and they carry it in a beer cooler. You know, but these organs were functioning.
Did they see this research as something that would benefit mankind or benefit Charles Lindbergh and Alexis Carrel?
Well, in the beginning, I think Lindbergh was trying to help his sister-in-law. But then he would have these early morning discussions in Carrel's office with Carrel. Carrel was a great talker. And after a while, Carrel decided his patient wasn't a man. It was mankind. And when he looked around, he saw a lot of turmoil, a lot of things that made him unhappy. But what made him most unhappy was that the white race that had built civilization was in danger of drowning in a sea of inferiors. And if they could come up with a way to keep a white elite alive longer than other people, separate those elite, put them in an institution who would tell the rest of us essentially how to think and live, that was the solution that Carrel came up
with. And it wasn't just whites. It was certain whites. He also said civilization was already encumbered with those who should be dead,
yes,
the weak, the diseased, and the fools.
Yes. Yes, that's a very eugenical belief, and that's something he believed. And he once gave a speech at the New York Academy of Medicine here in Manhattan, and he said that that immortality for too many people would be a disaster, you know, because the wrong people would live too long.
And who did he think would be making the decision as to who was worthy of immortality?
Well, he thought people like himself, of course, and he had an idea for something called the Institute of Man, where the greatest scientists and thinkers would be isolated in almost monastic isolation, and would basically decide that very question.
Now, he was not just speaking in the wilderness. He published a book of his thinking that became a bestseller, didn't
it? Yes, it did. He wrote a book called Man the Unknown. It was published in 1935, and by the end of 1936, it was the best-selling nonfiction book of the year. It got him on the cover of Time magazine, and this was way before people like Julia Roberts got on the cover of Time magazine. You had to be somebody important. It was the only book that sold more copies that year was Gone with the Wind, ironically enough. But yeah, this book, if you read it now, it seems like a somewhat nutty screed in which he says things like, men of genius are not tall, women should not be educated, democracy is an error of the brain, welfare programs inhibit natural selection because they save the weak as well as the strong, all kinds of what we would consider really almost lunatic ideas. But you have to remember, this was the middle of the 1930s. The world was in turmoil. People were looking for a big answer. And some of the best minds in the world committed themselves to really big, really bad ideas.
How much time did Lindbergh spend in Carrel's laboratory?
He was there for five full years, basically from 1930 to 1935, with some interruptions. You remember, Lindbergh left the United States at the end of 1935 after the trial of Bruno Richard Hauptmann.
Had the kidnapping occurred while they were working?
Yes, there? And in fact, what's really interesting, one of the things that really excited me when doing my research was that, A, Lindbergh was in Carrel's laboratory the night the baby was kidnapped. And then secondly, what I learned was that it took 2 years to arrest Bruno Richard Hauptmann. And in the beginning, it was a terrible period for Lindbergh, as you can imagine. They paid a ransom. The body was found dead. There were gangsters living in his house directing the investigation because the police thought that maybe members of the Legs Diamond Gang had committed this crime. And everything about the search for the perpetrator failed, and he was in a constant state of agitation. The one place he found peace was Carrel's laboratory.
Well, since everybody was paying attention to Lindbergh, you would think that more people would know that he was spending so much time in Dr. Carrel's laboratory. Why do you think this is the first book to ever really explore this connection?
Well, you know, the experiments are mentioned in all of the major biographies of Lindbergh, and there even have been a few biographies of Carrel, but nobody really focused on what these experiments were about, which really was immortality. And Lindbergh made that clear late in life when he wrote a letter to Life magazine in which he kind of disavowed his interest in science, and he said, you know, there once was a time I tried to see if science could help me achieve physical immortality. It was the first time he said this in public.
Although he had already published in scientific journals, so people knew he was interested in science.
Well, they knew he was interested in organ perfusion. You know, the ultimate goal of this was really something that Lindbergh and Carrel kind of kept to themselves or like-minded people.
Lindbergh also did artificial hibernation experiments.
Yes, he did.
On primates.
Yes, he did. And one of the reasons he did that was that he went to India and he met yogis who could keep themselves alive way past 100 years while meditating in the Himalayas. So he was really interested. Well, what is it that they're doing that is keeping them alive? So he started doing experiments first with rodents inside of vacuum tubes. And then he and Carrel put monkeys in a big tank where they lowered the air pressure and the temperature to see if he would enter some kind of state of suspended animation. The experiments failed.
Although this is something that people have talked about again,
yes,
in recent times. Woody Allen even made a movie about
That's
it.
That's right.
David M. Friedman's book, The Immortalist, Charles Lindbergh, Dr. Alexis Carrel, and Their Daring Quest to Live Forever, is published by Echo. Lindbergh moved to England after the trial, How did he continue working with Dr. Carrel?
Well, he set up a laboratory of his own. He rented a house in Kent, and he just basically continued working, and they corresponded. They would send each other as many as 5 letters a week and would talk on the phone when they needed to.
Now, what happened when Lindbergh when Lindbergh met Hitler and seemed to suddenly fall in love with the Nazi ideal? After all, I'm assuming to some degree his experiences with Carrel made him more open to that kind of thing.
I would say you were right about that. But as I said, the one thing they disagreed were about the Nazis in particular. And just to clarify, Lindbergh never met Hitler in person. He saw him at the Olympic Games. He did go to the 1936 Olympic Games and saw Hitler, but he never met him. He did meet Goering and many other. You know, and Goering was the number two Nazi. So he met many major Nazis. The irony.
Well, he was given the Golden Nazi Cross.
Yes, he was. And, you know, the only other American to get that award was Henry Ford, who accepted it here in the United States. And Lindbergh and Ford did share certain anti-Semitic beliefs.
So he is an isolationist. He joins, or he supports anyway, the America First movement. He may have played a role in Chamberlain's appeasement of Hitler.
Yes. He was asked to give his assessment of the air power of England versus the France, Germany, Czechoslovakia, all of the... And he did visit all those... the Soviet Union, he visited all those nations as a private citizen to assess their strength in the air. And he did write a report, which was given not only to... by this time it was President Roosevelt, but it was also given to... Chamberlain in England, who read it before he got on the plane to sign the Munich Pact, which basically handed over a good portion of Czechoslovakia to the Germans.
Lindbergh was in England. Didn't Carrel return to France?
Yes, he did. And I should mention that there were times in the late 1930s where they lived on 2 tiny islands right off the coast of Brittany. Carrel had owned this island, had bought an island called St. Gildas with his Nobel Prize money in 1912. And it was a beautiful little island where at low tide you could actually walk to the mainland of France. And suddenly the next island over became available, and Lindbergh bought it. And he lived there in 1937 and 1938 in the summers, because the house there had no heating. But Carrel, you're right, did eventually return to France after the fall of France. And this was the beginning of the end of Alexis Carrel.
He lived under Nazi occupation.
Yes. What happened was he ended up meeting with Marshal Petain. And, you know, we here in America think of Marshal Petain as the collaborator. But in France, he was still known as the hero of Verdun. He was the greatest French general in World War I. He had stopped the German advance into France. He was the head of the collaborationist government. He spoke to Carrel and said, "You are the most famous French scientist in the world. You want to set up something called the Institute of Man? Well, why don't you set it up here in France, in occupied Paris?" And Carrel did.
And then he died?
He died soon after. The Institute was in existence for 2 years, not really long enough to do any serious damage, as one savvy reviewer of the book put it. And then after France was liberated, the Institute was closed down, and he was accused of being a collaborator, not officially. He was never brought to trial, but he died of really a heart attack, and his wife said a broken heart.
We have very little time, but Lindbergh seemed to change his mind after the attack on Pearl Harbor and the Germans declaring war on the United States. But he was suspect, so they wouldn't let him work.
Yes, you remember,
the
he had toured the country giving speeches attacking Roosevelt, attacking the Roosevelt administration as warmongers, and attacking the British. And in a famous speech on September 11th in 1941, yes, he said we must not give in to Jewish pressure to get into this war.
So did he later disavow these things?
He never disavowed that. He always said, "I was right about us staying out of the war, because look what happened. The communists took over half of Europe, and the Red Chinese are now our enemies in Asia." But he did change his mind about the pursuit of immortality, and he did change his mind about his commitment to a life of science, which he thought had led him astray.
But he also... got involved with the Maasai people.
Yes, he did.
So that would suggest that he gave up some of his racist
ideas. Gave up his some of his racist notions, but he never would admit that he'd been wrong about seeing the Germans as the protector of Western civilization against what he always referred to as the semi-Asiatic Russians. He always referred to them as semi-Asiatics and as communists. Of course, he was a fervid anti-communist, as was Carrel.
Hey, what do you think of the atomic bomb?
The atomic bomb, when he learned that it was dropped by a plane that had essentially the same engine that he had flown in the Spirit of St. Louis, but a larger version, of course, gave him great pause and made him think, my God, what have I given birth to? You know, those planes flew great distances to drop, those bombs. And he thought, this is not what I thought aviation was going to lead up to.
So that he had some misgivings about some of the things that he had done in the past, although he shouldn't have felt guilty about flying across the Atlantic.
No, he never did. But he never expected that it would change his life quite in the dramatic way it did. He thought his original plan was just to keep flying around the world in short little stints. And you have to remember, his motivation mainly was financial. There was a $25,000 prize offered to the first person to fly from New York to Paris without stopping.
Well, he sure got a lot of money after that.
Yes, he did.
David Friedman will be giving a talk and signing books tonight at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on 8th Street in the Village. And then next Thursday, the 11th, he will be giving a speech somewhere else.
At the Museum of Natural History.
His book, The Immortalist, Charles Lindbergh, Dr. Alexis Carrel, and Their Daring Quest to Live Forever, is published by Echo. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
On tomorrow's show, Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk discusses everything from Dostoevsky to how he's quit smoking. Then Jenji Kohan, who created the series Weeds, and David Simon, creator of The Wire, compare notes about writing for television and thinking outside the box. Plus, Please Explain is all about eyes. By the way, if you missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Rory Bernstein, Fran Jacobs, Tanya Wiedeking, and Jennifer Keeney-Sendro. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.